You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom, and I'm here with my lovely host, Paula Lazan-Ostman. And, of course, we've also got Dick Bierenbach joining us, so we're kind of a trifecta of hosts today. We'll start off with Paula. How are you today, Paula?
Doing excellent today. We've got a real field temperature up here in Boston of 89 and partly sunny. Feels like 100, though. Too humid.
That sounds exactly like the temperature down here in Florida. Paula, you need to move to Florida because when winter time comes, instead of all that snow that you get up there, you'd still be in this wonderful, balmy, now 70-degree weather. That's why we moved. You know, we've talked about this, I think, on the show, but anybody listening may not know. About 11 years ago, Nancy and I lived up in New Hampshire, and I flew out of Boston. International there, and liked the area a lot, especially in the summertime. But we started to realize after a while, it's as hot here as it is in Florida. Let's go to Florida. Let's start our retirement early. Well, I wouldn't say retirement, but we can kind of act a little bit like we're retired living down in Florida. And speaking of retired in Florida, Dick Bierenbach, how are you today?
I'm doing super. Speaking of weather, I talked to my daughter and stepdaughter. Both up in the Minnesota area. The one stepdaughter lives out in Washington State. She came to Minnesota for a wedding, and the heat and humidity were killing her. She wants to get back to Washington.
Wow. Huh.
At the time we were talking to her, our temperature was 90 with only 30% humidity.
Wow. Crazy. Crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
And all that weather is heading for Paula.
Well, you know, we had a tropical storm here off the coast, but it really, I don't know. I just got back from Madrid last night, but I was looking at the hurricane track, and it's going to just go out to sea into the Atlantic, kind of go north and east and not really go near anything. I don't know if it'll even get anywhere near Bermuda, but I guess we must have gotten some rain. But by the time we flew into Miami last night, it was, you know, around dinner time, so it's still light out. There were some thunderstorms, you know, in southern Florida, but none of that was being generated by the tropical storm off. What we need here in Florida is a tropical storm to come a little bit closer so we get a whole lot more of that rain. Several years ago, I think you remember, Dick, we had a tropical storm come by and didn't really hit South Florida, but it dumped about 10 or 12 inches of rain, and we could really use that right now. But in any case, well, hey, this is breaking news. The Senate, we've got this gang of six in the Senate who's come up with a plan that the president says he kind of likes. Now, if the president says he kind of likes it or likes it at all, I'm against it because this guy wants to destroy our economy. He's made it clear. And I'm going to go to another article here in a second that explains exactly why he wants to destroy our economy as well as our country. But first of all, this gang of six has come up with a plan that will immediately impose $500 billion in deficit cuts. Now, when we say $500 billion in deficit cuts, we don't mean $500 billion next year. We mean $500 billion over 10 years. So this is the same old song and dance that we always talk about on the show, Paula, about we're not going to cut any actual debt, and the deficits, annual deficit spending, all we're really going to do is decrease it. And the way we're going to decrease it is instead of printing money, we're going to take more of the people's money so that we don't have to deficit spend. They're just going to put us in a deficit. So that's that plan. Now, here's the interesting thing about it. It says not only deficit cuts, but cut security and non-security spending over 10 years. Wow, let's cut security because, you know, we're so safe right now and there aren't any threats out there. That's smart. But over 10 years with spending caps, make the Medicare and Medicaid health care programs operate more efficiently. Now, wait a minute. Operate more efficiently? Dick, didn't Obamacare do just that? Why are we having to pass a bill to make things – so what they're going to do is they're going to claim that they're going to save us money by making Medicare and Medicaid more efficient when that's precisely what Obamacare did, and that's precisely why the president could say, I'm going to save us money because I'm making Medicare and Medicaid more efficient with this health care bill. So we're double dipping now. We're double counting savings, aren't we? Isn't that what we're doing, Dick?
That's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah. This is ridiculous. And I can tell you right now, when we dig in, whatever compromise our legislators come up with, when we dig into those savings, we're going to find savings from programs, number one, that were going to go away and be terminated anyways, so it's not really a saving, and other ghost-type savings. We're going to find that if they say we're going to cut 3.7, let's see what this says, I think 3.75 trillion over 10 years. Well, first of all, deficit spending is going to run our debt up by $9 trillion over the next 10 years. So cutting 3.75 reduces our national debt from $18 trillion to about $14.25 trillion, which is right where it is today, right? So, and I'm sorry, that's public debt. That's not the private debt as well. So in reality, you're talking about 10 years from now, public and private debt that the U.S. government holds is going to be somewhere around $25 trillion. So let me redo my math there. Our total debt is going to be over $20 trillion. But they're going to pat themselves on the back with this and go, see, we are being fiscally responsible. Well, what about 10 years from now? What's the total debt going to be? Well, we don't want to talk about that. But look how much we cut. My gosh, this is just ludicrous. It's insane. And Americans really need to wake up. But let's now go to the other article that I wanted to talk about. Obama promises job-killing tax. This is in his words. I've listened to the video. I've got the text of it. Obama promises job-killing tax increases after 2012. And he also says, now get this one, Paula, job losses prove that the stimulus worked. Does that make any sense at all? Job losses today prove that the stimulus worked. Have you heard that one yet in the media, Paula?
No, but why would he say something like that?
I'm going to tell you why, because the man is, quite honestly, he's an idiot. And I'm going to prove it right here. Okay, so here's what he did when he talked about the job-killing tax increases. What he was saying was this. We don't want – okay, I'm just going to quote him. So when you hear folks saying, well, the president shouldn't want massive job-killing tax increases when the economy is weak. Okay, well, when should we want massive job-killing tax increases? According to Obama, once the economy's strong. So this is what he said. Nobody's looking to raise taxes right now. We're talking about potentially 2013 in the out years. Okay, so he just said it. He's willing massive job-killing tax increases after the economy recovers. That's what he just said. The guy's a complete idiot. He didn't say tax increases. He said massive job-killing tax increases. Now, here's the question. If tax increases are massive job-killing increases today in a weak economy, what are they in a strong economy? Job boosting? Does that make any sense, Dick? No. If they're job killing today, they're job killing in the future. It doesn't matter how good the economy is. They might not be as job killing. But this guy, so this is what he's doing. Now, I want to make a very important point about tax increases. If we take the millionaires and billionaires and tax at 100%, now they're already paying probably around 40%. I think the top tax rate's at 39%, but you figure in a few other little subtleties there. We're just going to round it off to 40%. So the most we can get out of them is another 60% to get up to 100%. You don't even put a dent in the annual deficit, let alone go anywhere near the national debt. Now, if you take people making $87,000 all the way up to the millionaires and billionaires and take 100% of their income a year, so in other words, whatever tax bracket they're in, if they're in 22% or 34% on, you bump them right up to 100%. Now, that percentage that they're already paying, the 22%, for example, we'll say, we're already getting that. So we can't add that to the revenue. It's already there. It's already part of the revenue. But if we take everybody making $87,000 a year and take all of their income, period, you barely get to about half of the annual deficit. You don't even do anything about the national debt. So he cannot solve this problem by taxing the, quote, millionaires and billionaires, which now millionaires are defined as making over a couple making over $250,000. Dick, what is a million? That's a million, right? One,
Yeah.
And six zeros behind it. What's 250,000? That's a quarter of a million. But according to this president, you're a millionaire slash billionaire if you make 250,000. And most of the people making that kind of money aren't, you know, big wig executives. They're stealing money from the little people in their company, which there's no such thing as that. But they're probably most likely small business owners. And that kind of money, when you're a small business owner, you have a really good year or even a series of good years making money, you tend to reinvest that and grow and feed on that so that you can grab up more clients and grab up more opportunities, because you never know when it's going to dry up. You never know. How many small business owners have you known over the years, Dick, who did really well for a while and then for whatever reason they hit hard times?
It happens to most of them at one time.
It happens, yeah. In fact, most of them, if you talk to somebody that's, you know, at retirement age now and say, look back on your career, we'll find somebody, and I know people like this that have spent their whole life owning their own businesses one way or another. You know, somewhere after probably their late 20s, they started their own little construction business and on. And there's always changes in whether you want to call it technology or what people are looking, want out of life, et cetera. And so, you know, for example, remember calling cards? There was a time where I was selling calling cards back in the 90s, early 90s, because cell phones were just too expensive and nobody really even had them. People had pagers, but they had the ability to go to a payphone. You can't even find a payphone in a we're calling our guest, so if anybody out there hears the phone ringing, we're calling our guest, Ruth DuPont Esser, who's going to join us today. So that's what Paul is doing. In any case, no, I lost my but yeah, so in any case, that's what we're looking at. So this president thinks you're a millionaire when you only make $250,000. Well, wow, I just don't get that. And with inflation and the cost of living having gone up over the years, $250,000 might have been like living like a millionaire today 30 years ago, but it's today compared to 30 years ago making $250,000, it's like making $100,000. I mean, it's just it's not the same thing. And so in any case, that's my point on taxes. It's very important to understand that we can't. So here's the deal. Now, I'm gonna ask you this, Dick, because I know you know the answer. If he gets his taxes now, the president gets the taxes that he wants now, but after 2012, let's say he gets reelected, heaven forbid, he gets reelected, we're going to find out that adding new rates to the rich, the so-called rich, doesn't hardly do much to the annual deficit and doesn't do anything to the national debt. Who's left that he can go after?
There's nobody left.
Well, us, right on down to the poor. He's going to say, listen, we've gone after the rich. I promised you I'd go after the rich, and they're now paying their fair share. But we're still having a problem with the debt, and we've got to get it under control. So we need everybody to pitch in. Well,
the
you don't have to worry
to
about
get
getting
the debt under control is stop spending.
Yes. Now, I want everybody out there to ask the media. Anytime you come in contact with the media, or if you've got some emails that lists, etc., ask them that they need to ask the president. We need to push for this. Ask the president, will you commit to not raising taxes on the middle class if you win in 2012? Dick, I guarantee you he will not do it. He'll dance around it and say, like, well, we can't, you know, make promises about stuff in the future. Well, you do it all the time. The thing is, you are constantly lying about knowing that you will never live up to those promises. But the one promise he has lived up to in terms of direct taxes is he has not raised direct income taxes on anybody below 200, but he wants to. He wants to desperately. Once he gets reelected, there'll be nothing holding him back, and he will immediately come after us and have his excuse for why he's got to tax everybody, every single person. Now, he'll say, well, even the poor people, you know, they'll get a rebate on it, and, you know, they'll get their money back. So, but everybody's going to have to pitch in. And here's my theory as to why this is so important. We've got to get the federal government big enough that it can take over everything from the state governments. There's a certain size. There's a certain amount of GDP that he needs to be bringing in to have the federal government be big enough to control everything and just basically take everything over for the state. State governments can just go away. And I think that's what he's going for. He needs that kind of money. He doesn't care about the debt. The debt is meaningless. Once the federal government is in control of everything, then the debt is meaningless. It really is. then they can start cracking down on rationing, whether it be food, health care, gasoline, electricity. They can ration everything, and the states can't stop them because they'll be in control of them.
First World War.
Yeah, the states will, you know, they always like giving up some of their sovereignty if the government says, hey, we'll pay for this. We'll pay for this. So that's a big part of it. Now let's go to this other statement he made in this article that, you know, so there's the taxes, job-killing tax increases. He's going for it, and he's coming after the middle class. I guarantee it. He will not commit to not taxing the middle class after 2012 if he wins. But here's what he said. Now this is where Paul and I, you and I were talking about this. Job losses prove that the stimulus works. Now, here's how he does this. He said, in the beginning, when we were providing stimulus money to the states, and I'm going to come back to how much of this actually went to shovel-ready jobs, but when we were providing money to the states to create jobs, they were creating jobs, you know, construction, highways, things like that, and jobs were being created. Once we stopped giving stimulus money to the states, those jobs went away. So it proves that the stimulus works. What kind of logic is that? In other words, I guess what the answer then is, Mr. President, we need a permanent stimulus plan where we just funnel money to the states constantly so that they can create part-time temporary jobs and they'll always have those jobs and then all of a sudden unemployment will be up. I mean, do you get that, Paula? The stimulus worked because it created jobs as long as we gave money to the states, but once we stopped giving them money, all those jobs went away. That proves it worked.
Yeah, but I think the key word, and I might be mistaken, guys, is the key word is that they're giving the money away to the states, and once they realize that they were giving the money to the states, they went, whoops, can't do that.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find his actual quote on that. Okay, here it is. The discouraging jobs report that just came out, and in this article, I'm going to tell you where this article is. Go to Floyd Reports. You're going to have to Google it because I've just got it saved on my laptop here. But Floyd Reports, just Google Floyd Reports and look for Obama Promises Job-Killing Tax Increases. And there's other websites that have it. You can even just Google Obama Promises Job-Killing Tax Increases. Okay, so here's his discussion about why recovery, and here's what they say, recovery summer 2.0. Remember last summer, Biden said, this is the summer of recovery. The White House put out a flyer saying it's the summer of recovery, and you may be wondering why we're scaling back on some of the stimulus money. It's because things are going so well. so well. And here we are in the next summer of recovery. Well, here's what he had to say. Said, without relitigating the past, I'm absolutely convinced, and the vast majority of economists are convinced. See, this is another lie. The vast majority of economists are not convinced at all that the steps we took in the Recovery Act saved millions of people their jobs or created a whole bunch of jobs. Wow, he's so definitive. He knows the numbers so well, doesn't he, Dick? A whole bunch of jobs, bunches and bunches. Well, what is that? What is a whole bunch of jobs? Is that 20? Is that 50? Is it 800 million? I mean, what is whole bunches of jobs? And part of the evidence of that, as you see what happens when the Recovery Act is phasing out. When I came into office and budgets were hemorrhaging at the state level, part of the Recovery Act was giving states help so they wouldn't have to lay off teachers, police officers, and firefighters. And we've seen that federal support, and as we've seen that federal support for states diminish, you've seen the biggest job losses in the public sector, teachers, police officers, and firefighters losing their jobs. Wow. Well, that was a smart move, Mr. President. You gave the states money for something that wasn't going to last. And so that's just money down the drain that we, the taxpayers, have to fund. You're a genius. You are just an economic genius. We need to hire you, even after you're retired. We need to hire you to come into every state and tell us how to thrive and create jobs and fix the economy. What a absolute total moron. Okay, so that's the kind of stuff he's out there saying. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. Stimulus money. Our stimulus is proven because we're losing jobs now. So we know that the stimulus worked now that we're losing jobs. And massive tax increases coming after. And here's the thing. He's essentially predicting that after 2012 or 2013, the economy will be recovered. And that's when we can afford to issue massive job-killing tax increases. Well, wait a minute. 2 years ago, he predicted the economy would be recovering now. He's not going to wait. The economy could dip into a depression. If he gets reelected, tax increases are coming to everybody. Now, Dick, there's another way he can tax us without raising our income tax, and that is by jacking up corporate tax rates, because the big evil corporations are stealing from us, Dick. They're stealing from us right out of our pockets. Any industry that has, for example, a 10% profit margin, let's quadruple their corporate tax rate. Do you think next year, Dick, that they will not any longer have a 10% profit margin?
That's what he's been doing for a long time.
That's what he says. But they will still have a 10% profit margin. They will have a 10% profit margin, and who's going to foot the bill for quadrupling their corporate taxes? We, the consumer. Okay, here's the second way, a value-added tax. If you don't know what a value-added tax is out there, a value-added tax is, let's say we make something. Let's say I make T-shirts here in the U.S. I buy the fabric for somebody that actually manufactured the fabric. Well, when I buy it, I pay a tax on that fabric. Now I have my people sew it into T-shirts, and then I sell it to a store. The store then pays the same rate of tax that I paid on it to get it from the fabric manufacturer. Then they put it on the rack, and you go buy that T-shirt, Dick, and you pay that same rate of tax. So multiply that tax times 4. Let's say it's just 3%. We go, hey, it's just a little 3% value-added tax. I mean, look, if you go to buy something for $100, you're really only paying $103. It's to help the company, the economy. Well, let's take that 3% and multiply it by 4. It's not 3%. It's 4% that you, Dick, and I will pay, because everybody in that chain of creating that T-shirt is going to just add that tax to their bottom line. They're not going to pay it. They're not going to take in the short. So once again, it's the consumer. So between a value-added tax and raising corporate taxes on the big, bad, mean companies, we're going to be paying potentially, and I don't know what numbers they're going to come up with, but we're going to be paying potentially for goods and services anywhere for everything that we buy, electricity, need to get a new car, a house, food, clothing. Everything you buy is going to be up probably a good 25% when it's all said and done. So it's really sort of a consumer tax is what it is. And the companies that are making things, but here's the problem. It hurts us competitively with the rest of the world. Nobody wants to come here and do business. None of our companies that manufacture things can sell them overseas, because nobody's going to pay all that extra tax. Only Americans are going to pay it. So we're going to become an island within ourselves, taxing ourselves into oblivion. And that's his plan. I guarantee it. So he's either going to raise income taxes, which is a lot of people are going to squeal over it, but our legislators are going to go, you know what? We're in such bad shape. This government, this economy is going to collapse. We're just going to have to tax everybody and raise everybody's taxes. But I also see a value-added tax coming because it's insidious, and raising corporate taxes. And that will just destroy the economy, because there are too many companies that rely on exports and business from around the world. We already have the second highest. We're just a fraction behind Japan on corporate tax rate. And that's one of the reasons that we have a problem with all the trade deficits that we have with so many countries around the world. So anyway, I think our guest is here. Let's bring her on. Ruth DuPont Esther, how are you doing today, Ruth?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us today. Now, I'm going to give you a quick little introduction here to the folks, but you were a candidate for the Santa Rosa County Commission. You've been a business owner, developer, contractor, and your business, according to Dick, who's online here with us as well, was directly affected by the Agenda 21 issue that may have affected you in Santa Rosa County. And at the time, you really didn't know what that was about, but you've learned something about that. So in any case, tell people how they can find out more about the kind of things that you become an activist with, groups, websites, et cetera. Maybe you have one, Facebook, whatever it is, whatever you want to put out there. And then tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Yes, I've worked in the field of land development for years, not knowing that I was completely involved in Agenda 21 at the bottom level. They speak about doing top-down, bottom-up. Well, bottom-up is our local government, and it is the things they do to us in order to control our land and our water and our food supply.
Uh-huh.
They do very well. It is extremely intelligently designed. They work through our county commissioners. They work through our planning and zoning person. They work through our mayors. They bring in smart growth. They bring in ICLEI, and ICLEI does not use its name. It goes through local government commission. It works through Congress for New Urbanization, the LEED program. When you hear people say they're LEED certified, that's ICLEI. They are doing things such as the Numeric Nutrient Criteria Act, which is to demand that we use reverse osmosis on our water to a degree that is so high that, number one, it cannot be accomplished. There is no mechanism through which to do it. And also, it would bankrupt our whole state if we did. This is in Chapter 18 of Agenda 21. Also, alternate water mains, such as the one that is designed to go around Highway 98 through Navarre, through Destin, on around the map, of which it would then take control of the water companies. They claim that they want this main to maintain us from droughts. That's not a fact. Once that line's turned on, you cannot turn it off. The water would become stagnant. The water only flows in one direction. So if you have a drought in South Florida, taking our water from us will simply put us in a drought. And if we are in a drought, you can't get water to us. But what you can do is take and give power to the water management districts, and then they can state how much water we can use and how much we pay for it. And bigger than that, they control tap fees. If you want to put in a business or a resident, you have to be able to buy a tap fee. If you cannot do it, you cannot build that building. They have total control of construction through this. The water management districts function underneath DEP. DEP functions underneath EPA. EPA functions through contract, of which I possess, under UNEP. UNEP was started by Maurice Strong, and he also made himself its president. He also started UNDP. He creates these different entities under the United Nations. He sits himself and other people like him at the top of them, and they control them. All this is happening under the Earth Charter, and the Earth Charter was co-authored by Maurice Strong and Mikhail Gorbachev, and if you'll look at the Soviet Union Charter, the Earth Charter is created from it, and all these things that are happening in our county are coming from that piece of paper. They're not functioning outside of our government. They're functioning inside and outside of the government. And they are creating laws from the federal level down that mandate that we function under United Nations intentions rather than through the free market system that we know as the United States.
Wow. Now, what do you think the ultimate goal, the ultimate purpose of this all these efforts are, these subliminal and subversive efforts at the local level?
They want to create a one-world government that is communistic. They do not have an appreciation for America or the free market system. They want to flip us into communism. And
why do you think these county commissioners are buying into this stuff?
Money. They number one, they do not believe it. They think it's just a conspiracy theory. And the problem is conspiracy theories don't have facts that line up one behind the other. But also, this thing's created very intelligently. There are tons of grants. They come from EPA, they come from HUD, and they come from the Department of Transportation. So these guys have our economic council hiring someone to do nothing but bring in grants into our counties, and they're just finding this festive of grants that are coming from these entities that are wanting to bring us into this new world government that they create that is communistic.
Okay. Now, what would be the what's the way to break the cycle and get our localities, whether it be cities and counties and townships, out of this cycle and away from these grants and falling for this Agenda 21 stuff?
It's going to take the local people. It's going to take we the people. We cannot depend on any elected official. We can't even depend on the people that we've hired to sit in the seats, such as in planning and zoning. They've drank the Kool-Aid, and they do not want to listen and hear that there's a problem. So it's going to depend on us. We're going to have to get together the masses, and we're going to have to demand that these people listen to us or that we will take them out of their seats. We need our elected officials to listen and to dig into this and to look for the facts and to start representing us. Right now, that's a very difficult climb. On August 13th, I am having an event called Operation Paul Revere. I will have John Cassie, who is an environmental scientist that wrote three books. One is Cole's Son. He debunks climate change. He says it's not caused by man. It is a cyclical thing. I'm going to have a guy with fisheries, a lady who is retired from education. I want different people from different fields to come in and speak to the people as to all the avenues that Agenda 21 puts its tentacles into so that they can have a broad picture of how it functions. We are inviting all our elected officials by handwritten letters, asking that they come. We're going to spend time from 8 in the morning to 4 in the evening showing this to people. I personally am going everywhere that I can. I'm speaking on radio shows. I'm going to speak at different events. I'm doing PowerPoints. I'm just trying to wake people up and show them the exact details, not just of the fact that Agenda 21 exists, but the exact fact of the buildings and the projects under our feet that are taking place that are Agenda 21 projects.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Do you think any politicians will show up?
I hope that they do. We are doing all that we can to work from inside of the Republican Party. I am calling on people in the Democratic Party. I am calling people in the churches. We're doing all that we can do to try to get their attention. But it might be that we have to educate the people first, and then that the political people will get a hint that this exists and come on board.
Do you think we really have the time to educate all the people that aren't listening right now?
I would tell you that I am scared to death that we don't, but that we do not have a choice of failure in this. I would rather fight this thing, a free person, till my death than live 1 hour in its success, which means I am a serf, a slave.
Well, now, where is this going to be happening? Give us the date, and how, is there a website that gives people information so they can follow up with this Revere rally that you're talking about, Ruth?
Yes. It's called OperationPaulRevere.com. If they go on that website, they'll see all the details, and they can even RSVP should they choose. It will be held in East Milton at the fairgrounds. We felt that that was close to the interstate and should be easy to find. And there's a map and the address on that website.
Okay.
And they can contact me through that website by writing to saveamerica@operationpaulrevere.com.
Okay. Very good. And are there any other groups? Like if somebody wants to get educated on Agenda 21, is there a good website for that?
I wish. I would say look into some of the work by Mr. George Washington Hunt. Look at Joan Vian. Look at Dr. Michael Kaufman. You can pull up Agenda 21 on the Internet very easily. However, there is, like anything on the Internet, some very good information and then some slightly skewed information. I'm working right now. With every hour that I have to spend on it, to create information that we know is correct to put out there. But it is something that you do have to dig through and make some judgment calls on.
Okay. Well, I know another way that we can get rid of this Agenda 21 going on, and you're working at it at the local level because, quite honestly, at the federal level, we may not be able to do anything. But the reality is we need to dismember, disband, or at least shrink significantly the departments you talked about, HUD, EPA, Department of Interior, Agriculture. That would just neuter them, and they wouldn't have the ability to give these grants to all the different local regions within the states and push this agenda. They would have to stick to what they were actually chartered to do, and that is oversee, certain aspects of safety within their industries in the country instead of trying to push an agenda. It's one thing to oversee safety. It's another thing to then push an actual agenda that creates politically and or socially a whole another type of culture. So that's something that we need to work at the federal level. And I don't have a lot of confidence in them. But at the local level, it sounds like people like you are having an effect. So they can come in and try and push this. What will happen is the federal government will start to get pushy about it. They'll come in and go like, you're going to actually have to do this now. We don't want to do it. We don't want to take the grant money. Well, you're going to have to do it. And that's where state sovereignty. I think we're going to see a real revolution in state sovereignty. You know, nobody was talking about this a few years ago, although I was, you remember, Dick, when I was campaigning. But I think state sovereignty is going to become a big issue. That's how Thomas Jefferson got elected. If the federal government hadn't pushed too far, Jefferson wouldn't have gotten elected. I think Adams would have gotten a second term or somebody else would have been elected, but it would not have been a Republican. It would have been a Federalist, which I consider today's Democrats. But that's what happened. State rights issues became a big forefront, and I think it's going to happen again, but I'm just afraid that, you know, we may be a little too late. I don't want to ever say we're too late. We're never too late. I'm just afraid that our leadership is going to be too weak, and we can keep getting rid of incumbents and people in the federal government, but it just seems like every time somebody gets there that, you know, seems to be a pretty good conservative, they end up caving in. Too much pressure. I know things now that I didn't know before and all this kind of stuff. You know what? Too bad. Just go there and do what we elected you to do instead of
not to interfere, but Rick Scott is helping us beautifully. We're writing letters to all our officials. I wrote one to Rick Scott, to Governor Rick Scott. I wrote one to Attorney General Pam Bundy. I wrote one to our Lieutenant Governor. I just handed one to Adam Putnam, Commissioner of Ag. And he cut DEP gravely, and he cut the water management districts gravely. So we're having small success. But you're absolutely correct about we're running on the very last inch of time.
Yeah, in so many ways. So it's interesting to hear somebody like you talk about what's going on down at the local level, and it's just as bad as this stuff we're watching going on at the federal level. And one of the things that I learned by getting involved in politics several years ago was that most Americans are very, very uninformed about state and local issues. We're bad enough as an entire nation about federal issues, but we're horrifically bad about state and local issues. And that's why our state legislators and our county representatives can just trample all over the state constitution and the U.S. Constitution, and we just don't know about it until next thing we know. It's like, how come my property taxes are so high, and how come I can't, add this onto my house, and how come these businesses are shutting down because, you know, they say they can't afford to stay in business here in this town. I mean, you know, that's when we notice it, but we don't see it coming because we don't pay attention. And so my advice to most people out there is, there's a lot of people watching what's going on at the federal level. If you got some time on your hands, get involved at the local level, and you're going to be shocked to find out what your local officials are doing to you.
Yes. And unfortunately, if we lose this, we're going to lose it at that local level.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dick.
I have been to our council meetings, county council meetings, mainly because I live in the county. I don't have residency in any city in Florida. The county council will let you come up and talk for 3 minutes. And basically what you're doing is whistling into the wind. They've already made up their mind what they're going to do.
Yeah.
One of the things they have going for them is time of meetings. If a person is working, they can't afford to take off in this economy to go to a county council meeting and voice their disapproval. So what you end up getting is 10 or 20 people from a 9-12 group coming in and three or four of them talking for all of us. That does not impress the county council. What we have to do is, we've got so many unemployed people in all of the counties. We have to find a way to get them to the county council meetings. And I mean every meeting. Flood the room. Take over the meeting from the county council. Tell them what they are going to do. You work for us. Either you do it or pack your bags. We're taking over the county council. Your choice. Do it our way or leave.
Yeah. Well, that's, I agree with that, and that's what's got to happen. But there's just, you know, we got to get more people involved. There are too many people that aren't aware of what of what's going on. You know, if you filled up one of those council meetings, the chambers of one of those council meetings with a bunch of people that were not happy, you'd start to get their attention. And then that's precisely what you did, Ruth, was running for a commission seat. You know, if you can get some traction early on and get some attention, it's just that most people are like, yeah, what's a county commissioner do? And they don't know what's going on. And it's a tough thing running a campaign, and it can wear you out. But if you can get elected, boy, once you're in there, you can really mess up their plans and disrupt things. And that's really the key, is to get folks elected. So as I think more people are becoming aware of some of these issues. And, you know, in Volusia County there, Dick, you've got Margie Padgett running again for a county commission. I think commissioner at large is what she's running for. And
she ran for that last time. That's not up this time.
Oh, it's not? Okay, what is she running for this time?
I don't know if she is running. Right now she's working on the taxes.
Okay, I thought she was running again, quite honestly, because that's the way it looks on her website. But whatever, but that's what we need to do. We need to get grassroots citizens in there that don't have a personal agenda and understand these things. And so are you making any plans to run again anytime soon, Ruth?
At this time, I'm not going there yet because this other has become such a big thing. And it's so dangerous to our freedom that right now I've decided to put every drop of my blood into this thing and to make it my life's journey to get our politicians who do have the responsibility of protecting us to listen, to learn, and to stand by our side. We can't just keep voting new people in because time is passing and time is the friend of our enemy. And so we have got to make it our life's mission to take the people that are in those seats and show them how their life will change grotesquely if they do not help. The biggest, hardest hurdle I have to deal with is to convince them that this is real and that it affects their life. Because unfortunately, too many people in these seats are not in these seats for us, but rather for themselves. And so it's now become my job to show them how their life changes if they don't help them with this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's great. Let's see. Dick, any other questions for our guest?
I've got an idea. I think part of the problem is communication. We look at Volusia County, for example. There are roughly 5 or 6 different 912 groups in Volusia County.
Yeah.
Okay. What we're not doing is getting to a lot of the people that don't come to the meetings and never heard of the meetings.
Yeah.
We just had a meeting recently with some people that showed up, had no idea what 912 was. Okay.
Yeah.
If you got all these people that come to these meetings, 30, 40, 50 people at a meeting, ask them to give a dollar. We want to take out ads in the paper. We're going to organize. We're going to try and get all the unemployed to start showing up at every county council meeting. Take out ads in the paper. The paper cannot refuse a paid ad.
Yes.
Advertise in the newspapers. Get the word out through all the local talk shows in the area. Call in the talk shows and get them to back you up.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to get the unemployed to start showing up. They've got nothing to do anyway. Why not hop in the car and make life miserable for the county people that put them in the position they're in?
Yeah, that's a very good idea.
But we have to organize the 912 groups together. Obviously, the leaders of the groups don't have this kind of money, but if you got 50 people that show up at one meeting and each one gives a dollar for an ad,
yes,
we can have an impact.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, excellent.
We need to do that, and I'm going to be putting together a disc that have all the details of this, and then I'm going to start selling them, and I'm going to be taking some of the money from that and putting it into trying to get radio time and such. And we do have to get this on the air. Unfortunately, there's not enough places to get the information out there so that the everyday person that's sitting at their house and working their job and going on about their life can stop and even hear about it. I walk into buildings and I say, has anyone here heard of Agenda 21? And unfortunately, it's a minority that picks up their hands and says yes. And that is the case with so many things.
Yep. Yep, exactly. Well, Ruth, any last words you want to leave us with before we...
Dick is right on it. We have got to grip hands with all the different parties, the 912ers, the Tea Parties. I believe that the fate of this country is sitting in their hands, but that they do have the power to pull this country through. And I ask that everyone please do their homework, look into the details of this and how it's being done and how they themselves are taking part in it in some way, because we tend not to know that. And I ask that people get active, and I ask that they come to the event we're going to do on August 13th. We could use all the support we can get. And other than that, I thank you for giving me some time on your station to get the word out. And please keep informing people about that and all the other things that are happening to us here.
We will. Thanks, Ruth. Appreciate it for coming on. And keep up the good work. Hang in there. We need more people like you, and you're right. Even if you're not running for office, you can't have an impact on your communities, local communities, and people need to wake up and see what's going on at the local level. So anyway, Ruth, thanks for joining us. Have a great rest of the week, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thank you so much.
So, Paula, what did you think of all of that?
Very enlightening. Nothing that I know about.
Most people don't. Most people don't. And now I wonder if anybody saw this. Dick, did you see this, that President Clinton, Mr. Impeachment, said that if he were president right now, he would invoke the 14th Amendment and raise the debt limit unilaterally. Now, we've talked about this before, but I have to talk about it again simply because it's in the news, and I want to make sure people understand that by doing that, if he were to do that or any president were to do that, they would actually violate the 14th Amendment. So here it is in Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, and then there's a bunch of stuff in the middle about what kind of debt we're talking about, says shall not be questioned. The key is authorized by law. If he unilaterally did it, that would not be authorized by law. The president cannot create law. He does not have any power found anywhere in the Constitution to create law. No, anything that he does in way of an executive order, which, by the way, is unconstitutional, is not law. The president cannot write law and make it the law of the land. So if the president were to raise the debt ceiling, he would create new debt. That new debt would not be authorized by law. Therefore, it could be questioned. Now, remember, the validity of the public debt shall not be questioned. It could be questioned because it would not have been authorized by law. So doing that is a violation of the 14th Amendment. More importantly, Section 5, right after that section that the libs like to look at and don't even know how to interpret, President Clinton is, for him to come out and say that, he's a smarter guy than that. He really thinks we're so dumb that we don't know what it actually says, but we do. Section 5 says, the Congress shall have power to enforce by appropriate legislation, again, the president can't write legislation, to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. It just says Congress has the power. Says it right there in the 14th Amendment. Doesn't say the president, doesn't say the judiciary, doesn't say the vice president, doesn't say the crossing guard down the street at the high school. It says the Congress. And finally, if we go to enumerated powers under Article 1, Section 8, second paragraph, the Congress, this is an enumerated power. Enumerated powers mean they get to do it, nobody else. Powers are not shared from branch to branch within the three branches of our government. That's what we call the separation of powers. Here is the enumerated power in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, to borrow money on the credit of the United States. That power is reserved only and solely for the Congress of the United States. And the 14th Amendment affirms that. So if Mr. Clinton were here right now, I'd say to him, Bill, you're going to violate the 14th Amendment and two other provisions in the Constitution. So you want to get impeached again? Is that what you're saying? You like being impeached? because this is an absolutely impeachable offense. So there we go. It's in the news again because President Clinton had to open his fat mouth and lie to the American people about the 14th Amendment. So here we've got a case of two things. We've got an ex-president who either doesn't understand the Constitution, and that's not a good thing, or we have an ex-president who's a liar. You take your choice. He's either incompetent or a liar. And our current president's the same thing. Well, I'm going to have to put my constitutional law hat on and my constitutional professor hat on, which he never wore. I'm going to leave that to the lawyers. Yeah, his lawyers have done a great job of misinterpreting the Constitution repeatedly. And we're going to find that out with Obamacare when it goes to the Supreme Court because it's completely unconstitutional. But we've got presidents, past and current, that don't understand the Constitution. So they're incompetent, or they understand it, but they're lying to the American people. Neither of those scenarios is good. Okay.
I've got a problem with something you've just said.
Say it.
He's either incompetent or doesn't know, or he's a liar.
Yeah.
He can be both, and he is both.
You're right.
Too many
people
have forgot. Pardon?
You know, Dick, you're right. In fact, most incompetents are liars.
A lot of people forgot during the Vietnam War, Slick Willie and his bride went to Canada to avoid the draft. They went up there burning flags. How the man made it as president is beyond me. He, like I say, he's incompetent and he is a liar.
Yeah, well, they all tend to be. Now, here's something interesting, Dick. I don't know how many liberal friends you have, and Paula, maybe you've got some, and if you've ever gotten a discussion with them. Here's what I find happens. Liberals are more than happy to try and make their point that, no, the 14th Amendment, or, you know, pick anything. No, we've got to raise the debt ceiling. That's the appropriate thing to do, and here's why. When you then prove to them that they're wrong, you know what they say? They go, well, it's too late, Tom. There's nothing we can do about it. If they don't know that you can explain away how they're wrong, then they will argue with you. Once you prove them wrong, they throw their hands up and go like, well, that's all politicians are liars, Tom. So in other words, so like I proved to one of my liberal friends that Obama is a liar, a pathological liar, in fact. And they throw their hands up and go like, well, you think John Boehner doesn't lie? It's like, wait a minute. We're not talking about John Boehner. We're talking about Obama, your guy. You told me, oh, no, he tells the truth all the time, Tom. Then when I proved to you he's a liar, then you go, then you divert it to show me how Republicans are all liars. Well, what about Richard Nixon? Well, he's dead, number one, and I really don't care. But they divert it. So whenever you prove them wrong, they divert it to something else. And then finally, and that's when you say to them, you're diverting this away from your guy. Your guy that you told me 5 minutes ago doesn't lie. I just proved he does lie. So what's the answer to that? We got to get rid of him, but you want to keep him. You want to keep a liar. Well, they're all liars, Tom. You want to keep all of them, right? I said, no, I want to get rid of all of them. How about that? Then they just throw their hands up. Oh, it's too late. There's nothing we can do. Oh, so next time you come to me and tell me something about from your liberal wish list, et cetera, I'm just going to throw my hands up and go like, you told me before, nothing we can do. So why are you even paying attention to this? That's what the liberals do. They do not exist on substance. They exist on lies and emotion, all of which fail them time and time again. So they must continue to steal more and more of our liberty and property to make themselves feel better somehow. It never works. So there's my rant for the day on liberals. Now, Paula, have anything in the news today catch your eye or in the last few days since we've been on the air?
Just recently with the debt ceiling with Obama. Praising the Gang of Six plan. That's much what stuck out like a sore thumb.
Well, I'm looking at an article right now that just came out minutes ago. The president likes this plan because it gets him through the election without facing a government shutdown. And Mitch McConnell likes it because he gets to force multiple votes on a subject that Democrats hate, raising the debt limit. Because here's what happens. It's got to be voted on now. And if they were willing to do this, I'm absolutely opposed to raising the debt at all. But if they're going to have to do it, let's make it got to happen in multiple amounts and or multiple times, but not like Mitch McConnell said, some supermajority. No, just a simple majority, because the president likes that. I just want a simple up or down. I just want a simple up or down. Let's start giving the president simple up or downs. Okay, so, Mr. President, you want to raise it to $500 billion. Okay, you've requested that. Now we can say that you've requested it. President wants to raise the debt ceiling. He wants to raise the debt on your children and grandchildren. Now let's all take a vote, and let's see which one of our blue dog liberals that claim to be fiscal conservatives votes to raise the debt ceiling. And now we do that multiple times, so over the course of the next year, we can point to these guys. You voted 4 times to raise the debt ceiling, the debt ceiling that our kids are going to have to pay off. Shame on you. I mean, that's not a bad tactic. It's the wrong tactic, though. The right tactic needs to be no debt ceiling limit. We've been raising the debt ceiling for decades, and now we're asked to compromise. We've compromised every time, every single time. Now it's time to say no more compromising. This is the end of the road, end of the line. You're done. But I don't think that's going to happen. What do you think, Dick? What do you think is going to happen?
I've got a simple solution to this whole problem. The president gives the counties and the states stimulus money to bring people to work and give them things to do. The federal government has no money. What he's doing is giving us our money back. Yeah. Why don't we just not send the money to Washington in the first place, keep it within our states, and we won't need stimulus money from a president?
Right. Well, you know, and that's really quite true. It was Alex de Tocqueville who said back in, I believe when he said this, wrote this, it may have been late 1700s, so prior to, sometime after we formed our nation and had a constitution. But he said, this government will last, here we go, the American public will endure until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's money. And you just said it. They're basically saying, hey, would you like some money? Sure, we'll take that money. By the way, you need to pay me for that first. You need to give me the money first so I can then give it to you. Well, that's really big of them, giving us our own money. Yeah, that's got to end.
Yes.
That's absolutely got to end. Now, I heard this on the Mark Levin show yesterday. Paul Ryan was on, and he said of the stimulus money, only 6% went for shovel-ready jobs, 6%. All of the rest of the money went to entitlement-type programs, helping, you know, save, you know, unions and prop them up in states and their entitlement programs. Only 6% of all that stimulus money. So we've played audio where the president talks about shovel-ready jobs, and they're there, and then we've played the audio where he admits there really is no such thing as shovel-ready jobs, and they weren't so shovel-ready afterwards. Ha, 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 really funny, big joke on the American people. And now we find out the numbers. 6% of $800 billion went to the, quote, shovel-ready jobs. And the reason they didn't wasn't because there weren't shovel-ready jobs like he says now. It's because it was payback time for all their cronies. What liberals have been wanting to do, programs and payoffs they've been wanting to do forever, this was the perfect excuse for them with this big crisis to take a bunch of money out of our pockets and hand it around to their friends. And that's precisely what happened. Well, I'm going to finish this segment up with a joke. Paula, have you ever heard that pilots in general, especially airline pilots, but pilots are cheapskates?
No, I've never heard that.
Well, it's a joke among us pilots because we tend to be cheapskates. If there's a happy hour somewhere with free food, you're going to find pilots there at the trough eating the free food. That's their dinner. So they're going out to dinner, eat the happy hour food, and that's good enough. Anyway, so with that background, knowing that we're cheapskates, and we're not all cheapskates, but anyways, we like
cops and pilots have a lot in common, don't they, Tom?
With what? Say that again.
Cops and pilots have a lot in common.
Yeah.
We know where all the coffee and donuts are.
That's right, all the free coffee and donuts, exactly. So anyway, there's a old-time bar in Yuma, Arizona, and these four guys are walking along, these four buddies, and they see this sign that says, old-time bar, all drinks 10 cents. No, can't be. So they go in, and they're thinking, there's got to be some catch to this or whatever. They go up to the bar. It's a really nice, fully stocked bar. It's got everything, wine, beer, every kind of beer you can think of, every kind of liquor you can think of. And they asked, really, 10 cents for a drink? Yep, 4 martinis. Coming right up. So the bartender brings over the 4 martinis. That'll be 40 cents. Wow, they can't believe it. They start sipping their martinis like, wow, this is real gin. It's not watered down or anything. Wow, this is awesome. So they order another round. The bartender comes over and brings them the next round. That'll be 40 cents. And they ask the bartender, so what's the deal with this 10-cent drink? How can you afford to do that? And the bartender says, well, I've always wanted to have a bar and be the bartender and own it and all that kind of stuff. So I used to be a tailor in Phoenix. moved here to Yuma, great place, kind of quiet place, and so that's what I'm doing. But the reason I'm able to afford all this is because I won the lottery. I won a lottery, with a $150 million lottery. So I got plenty of money, more money I could ever spend. And cost of living here in Yuma is pretty good. So that's it. Oh, wow. Okay. So they're sipping their martinis. They look down the far end of the bar, and there's about seven guys sitting down there. Just sitting there, not really chatting or anything, and just kind of sitting there. No drinks. And they haven't had a drink. They were in there before these guys came in, and they haven't ordered a drink in all this time. So they call the bartender back over, and they go, hey, what's with those guys down there? How come they're not drinking? They're just sitting here. He said, oh, those are a bunch of retired American Airlines pilots. They're waiting for happy hour when the drinks are 50% off.
That's a good one, Tom.
Talk about cheapskates. So, sorry, I had to drag that out a little bit, but I felt like it. And somebody in the chat room said, that's one long joke. You're right, it is, but it's a good one. So laugh, buddy. Anyway, all right, we're going to wrap things up. Last words, Dick?
No comment.
Okay. How about you, Paula?
Go
ahead, Dick.
I think Ruth has got some good plans and good ideas. I hope she has success with them.
Oh, we do, too. And we'll keep in touch with what's going on, and we'll see how her Paul Revere rally turns out. Hopefully it'll do well, and we can mimic that in some other places. Paul, any last words?
Good luck to Ruth, and a shout-out to our troops serving overseas, specifically in the Navy. Your families love and miss you dearly. We want you home real soon.
Yes, specifically the Navy. Well, we want them all, but yes. Of course, everybody knows I was in the Navy, so thank you for that. All right, tomorrow we've got Ambassador Stanley Escudero, a three-time ambassador. Go to the website. You can see the press release for that. He was in Iran during the fall of the Shah undercover. He had been there previously working out of the embassy. Went back, was undercover. He's the one that predicted the fall of the Shah, and the government really didn't like his prediction there, but it ended up happening. He knew it was coming, and we didn't really prepare for it too well. He's been a political liaison throughout the world, and as I said, a three-time ambassador to Tajikistan and two other stands. I don't remember which ones, but it's on the press release. Go check it out. Don't miss it. He's a great guy, got great stories. We're going to talk about the Middle East. We're going to talk about the government because he's gotten involved politically. It's going to be a great show. Don't miss it. And everybody have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow at 4 o'clock Eastern.
See you tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.